Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Negotiations over a new congressional redistricting plan may have fallen through last week, maybe not, after state lawmakers and citizens group representatives failed to find common ground. We'll talk about that and more today on our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us, Cincinnati Enquirer, state government reporter Jesse Balmer. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff. Well, welcome back, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back, Andy.
Morning.
All right. So what of this plan? Lawmakers and representatives from the citizens group, as of the end of last week, couldn't agree on a new way to draw, a new process by which to draw Ohio's congressional districts. What's going on?
So I think the sticking points Thursday of last week were Democrats and the kind of good government groups that are working on this ballot initiative were very concerned about the number of times counties could be split. The current version has 28 splits allowed, and they really feel like that is too many and would allow Republicans to essentially draw similar maps to what exists right now. And then the other kind of sticking point is this idea of representational fairness, or, you know, can you draw a district or should you be able to draw a district that favors one party over the other? And it's kind of a nebulous idea in some circumstances, but I think those were two of the main problems.
Yeah, those are the big issues right now. And the way you do hear the term representational fairness, and it's sort of a common term that we heard during the fight over the state legislative redistricting process, which was changed a couple years ago.
By way of ballot
and by a bipartisan resolution that passed through the House and Senate. But Republicans are kind of they're taking an issue with it this time around, saying that, well, I don't think that we should draw districts just so we can favor just to make sure that there are certain Democratic districts and certain Republican districts. It should just be actually representing not by partisan lines, but just representing communities.
Isn't the goal competitive districts?
The goal is competitive districts, and this idea of just, you know, living in the place. Living among people who are also in your neighborhood. So again, if you're living in Akron, not having somebody from Toledo representing you, that's an exaggeration. But, you know, living in the same city, living in the same region as the person who represents you, rather than having somebody two counties over representing you.
Well,
who doesn't represent.
Steve Stivers, who goes way beyond two counties over. Mm-hmm. He's from Upper Arlington, and he represents all the way down to the Ohio River, right?
Right. And so does that give you a representative who understands the issues you're going through and understands the economy of your region?
Sure. I mean, they're striving for compact communities of interest and also and competitive districts. But, you know, overarching all of this is it's all about political power and control and who calls the shots on basically who's going to represent Ohio in Congress for, you know, the next decade or even longer. Mm-hmm. And so this has been an extraordinarily difficult lift for, you know, to come to an agreement. And there's like three different groups that are kind of in the mix on this. There's the Republican lawmakers, the Democratic lawmakers, and then this coalition of 30 or so organizations called Fair Districts Equals Fair Elections. And, you know, if you look at the history of redistricting in Ohio, this has been, I think they changed to our current method back in 1967, and the Democrats were in control and they gerrymandered maps. Mm-hmm. in the decades in which they were in control, and the Republicans have gerrymandered maps in the decades since they've been in control. And so, you know, it's a matter of sharing power and sharing this decision making, and it's not an easy lift.
But they did it to get it on the ballot a few years ago, which voters approved. What's
that
the difference?
That was for legislative districts.
Right.
And, you know, the apportionment board drew the legislative districts, and then the legislature draws the congressional districts.
Right.
And this is sort of part two of that, which is the control of the congressional. I don't think, you know, I think that when they did the legislative districts, I think it was issue one on the 2015 ballot.
Mm-hmm.
I think that there was some opposition from congressional leaders that Ohio just not include congressional redistricting in that, and that's why now we still have that undone.
That's exactly what happened. When he was Speaker, John Boehner wrote a letter to lawmakers saying, do not mess with congressional districts. Let Congress deal with it. Let us deal with it on the national level.
They like
level.
It the way it is. Mm-hmm. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's a weekly reporters roundtable. We're talking about the challenges to reforming how districts are drawn, congressional districts are drawn in Ohio. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. So they have until February 7th to do this, right?
This is in order to get it on the May primary ballot, right, which is what the lawmakers are striving for. The Fair Districts folks, they're collecting signatures to put their own issue on the November ballot. So the Fair Districts people, their deadline is July 4th. The lawmakers, if they're going to put their own proposal up there, is going to be February 7th. And the Constitution says 90 days before the election. So they could conceivably file something with the Secretary of State's office at 11:59 p.m. on Wednesday. So if they do strike a deal and get the votes for it, then my prediction is that they'll be filing it at 11:58.
Because you've been there, done that?
Yeah.
Yeah, they never – I mean, stuff at the State House does not happen unless there's a hard deadline.
Yeah. So what do you think? I mean, Jesse Balmer, are they going to get it through?
Gosh, there's been so much back and forth like the past several weeks. But like Laura said, I mean, there's nothing like a deadline to get something done. Mm-hmm. It does seem like there were some discussions over the weekend between those three groups, Democrats, Republicans, and this Fair Districts Equals Fair Elections group. And so was speaking with one of the members of that last group who said, you know, kind of cautiously optimistic at this point. It looks like the Senate is scheduled session for, I believe, tomorrow. So that would be an indication that they might be ready to vote on something. But there's also been a lot of various hearings since then that have not come to fruition.
Well, last time I checked, there was an if needed session scheduled for today, unless that was canceled, too. So, I mean, we could see some movement as early as today. And kind of going off of what Laura said, there was a moment last week, I think it was either Wednesday or Thursday, where it seemed like there was movement. It seemed like that they were going to come to an agreement. And it all felt a little too early, actually.
I really do think
that because it was so early, when you're in a negotiation, you might say, oh, we have some time. Maybe I can just squeeze a little bit more of what I want out of this. And maybe I can get a little bit more leverage. And so I think that's another thing with the time that's allotted to them, is that I think they see it as an opportunity to really get the most of what they want, whether that's the citizens group, the Democrats, the Republicans. And I will add, I mean, every time we talk about redistricting, I think the really interesting thing here is, even though the Republicans are in control, they could pass whatever they want out of their chambers. But it's when it comes to redistricting, it helps to have the Democrats on board. It helps to have a bipartisan issue that they can put on the ballot, to have everybody singing kumbaya and pass it, because you don't know who's going to be in charge after the next census. You don't know who's going to be in charge when they are drawing up the district. So even though Republicans are in control now, they're trying to look at it from the perspective of what if they were in the minority and vice versa. Democrats,
which is what the Democrats failed to do the last time there was reform afoot.
Right. When in 2009 there was an option on the table and it didn't get passed. So I think that's another interesting element of the dynamic here, is that everybody's acting as if they – trying to imagine what they would want if they were in control, and trying to imagine what they would want if they were not in control.
And even Senator Matt Huffman, who's been kind of the main sponsor on this resolution as it's been going through, has said, you know, he doesn't think it would pass if the Democrats were against it. And I think, you know, if they're going to do something and bring it to the people on the ballot, they don't want it to fail. And if they don't have bipartisan support, he very much doubts that would be successful.
But I think maybe, Laura, you made this point, it's not just the Democrats, it's three interest groups, the coalition.
Right. And the Fair Districts Fair Elections group is, I think I counted, they have like 30 different groups, kind of led by the League of Women Voters of Ohio and Common Cause. And, you know, I can't imagine that they're all of one mind. It's a big coalition of volunteers and nonprofits that are interested in this. And so, yeah, I think it's a little unwieldy at this point. And, you know, the Fair Districts, if they're not satisfied that this is a good structure, then they still have the option of continuing to cover, collect their signatures and take it to the ballot. And then if they both pass, if both constitutional amendments pass, mm-hmm. there's a question of which one trumps the other. I checked with the Secretary of State's office on that last week, and they said, well, it kind of depends on how each is written and which sections of the Constitution are impacted.
Yeah, but I've understood that the Republicans won't take anything to the floor if they don't have that agreement all
that's,
around.
That's what they've been saying, that they don't want to pass anything that's not bipartisan.
Right, but they're saying bipartisan. So if they strike a deal with the Democratic mm-hmm. lawmakers.
But not the coalition.
Right, and the kind of the sounds that I'm hearing from the Democratic lawmakers, it's not, they're not of the same mind as the Fair Districts people. They want the Fair Districts people to be on board, but like I said, it's pretty unwieldy. There's a lot of moving parts.
And I would also add that there's also this other thing hanging out there, which is the current Congress members, the current members of Congress mm-hmm. who may or may not want to see the process change, because for them, the process has been working out pretty well for them where they don't have to have competitive districts. And that's not just Republicans. That's also the Democrats like Marsha mm-hmm. Fudge and Joyce Beatty who don't have to run against strong opponents in their districts.
Well, Congressional Black Caucus and Black Caucus in general in legislatures across the country have typically not been supportive of any changes because they protect their seats and they're afraid that that wouldn't occur.
They protect their seats, and they also believe that in a way, the way that Ohio draws their districts now does give minority voters some type of voice, because they do carve out these districts that do help people of color win the districts.
Well, that's only required, for one of Ohio's districts. It's Marsha Fudge's district, and that's required under federal law. But, you know, what's also interesting is that after the next census, Ohio is expected to lose another seat in Congress. Right. So there's sort of a musical chairs element to this in that, you know, no matter what, one of those incumbents is gonna get cut out of the deal. You know, I think that the current map also looks sort of like some of the individual districts look like a Rackshaw test, you know, like what
Rorschach.
Sorry. Yeah, like what is this? And I think that one of the most effective things that the Fair Districts people can say, you know, make their argument that we need a different process is just the current map,
because it looks so the map. Yes.
Odd. Yeah, there's that.
Somebody pointed out it to me recently that Jim Jordan's district looks a little bit like a duck. And once you see it, you just can't unsee it.
You can't unsee it. So you got the duck, and then you also have the snake by the lake, which
is it looks like rickrack to me.
Right, right.
The snake by the lake.
Oh, yeah, it does look like a duck.
Yep. Let me see.
Now,
okay,
I'll tweet it out. All sides on it.
There are also, you know, there's a number of cases working their way up through the federal courts challenging gerrymandered districts in other states. I think North Carolina, Pennsylvania, mm-hmm. Wisconsin.
Right.
So that's another element to this, is that they, as much as the party in control might want to, like, just really keep that grip firmly, you know, wrapped around the control, that you know, there's a chance that if they go too far, they're going to get slapped back by the courts.
Right.
So,
and I mean, in addition to John Boehner's general desire to not see anything change on congressional districts before, there was a redistricting case, you know, going to the Supreme Court. So they have in the past used court challenges as a kind of another reason not to touch this issue. I haven't heard that brought up as an excuse this time around, but, you know, another mm-hmm. thing to be watching.
Right. By the way, John Boehner is no longer Speaker of the House. Right. He's no longer even a member of the House.
He's mowing his lawn.
He's fixing his lawnmower.
Is that what he's doing?
There was a picture of him, like, tweaking his lawnmower and talking about his lawn. And
yeah, just a normal guy. We will continue our conversation. It is our weekly reporter roundtable, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Democratic and Republican women are calling for some kind of discipline for two state lawmakers who made lewd comments about fellow female lawmakers and joked about sexual harassment at a recent GOP social event. We're talking about that and more on our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Inquirer state government reporter Jesse Ballmer. Jesse, thanks again.
Thanks.
Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff. Laura, thanks again.
Hello.
And Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Thanks again, Andy.
Hey.
The two lawmakers in question are Representative Bill Seitz of Cincinnati and Senator Matt Huffman of Lima. You recently referred to him. He is the guy carrying the water on redistricting in the Ohio General Assembly. Both are Republicans. Both have since apologized, but that's about it. What's up with this?
I mean, essentially, there was a going away party for a Republican staffer. It was kind of billed as a roast. And both Senator Huffman and Representative Seitz spoke at this event. Mm-hmm. Seitz made some kind of derogatory comments about a fellow Republican lawmaker, a woman, a Butler County lawmaker named Candace Keller, who is a little bit further right than he is. And then also made light of sexual harassment allegations against Senator Cliff Height, who resigned earlier this year. And then Matt Huffman also made some comments and kind of an allusion to female genitalia. So basically the whole thing was considered inappropriate. Like you said, they apologized after the fact, but at least four Democratic lawmakers said last week that that was just insufficient, called for Representative Seitz to resign. Other people have called for him to lose.
Including the Anash DeBullo Republican running for state treasurer, Sandy O'Brien.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And others have called Representative Seitz has a leadership position in the House.
Mm, number three.
Some have asked for him to step down from that or lose committee positions. So there's a lot of discussion about why this was acceptable.
Because here's the rub. Speaker of House Cliff Rosenberger was in the event.
He was in the room.
He was in the room. He heard everything. Yeah.
Yeah. It's not hearsay. He was there, heard it, saw it happen.
So, yeah, I spoke. The legislative leaders were at this forum that the Associated Press put on last week. And I asked Speaker Rosenberger, I said, you know, you were at the event. Once it became clear to you the nature of the comments, why didn't you stand up and, you know, redirect or, you know, interrupt or what have you? And he said he felt uncomfortable by the remarks and that he didn't feel like that conversation could happen at that point in time. And he said, but, you know, the buck stops with me and I've apologized to everybody at the event and etc. But, you know, and then the other thing is I spoke with Representative Seitz and he said that he did not make offensive comments about Representative Keller, that the Third Rail blog was inaccurate, but he did make some references to a former state representative, Diana Fessler, from over in the Dayton Springfield area, and that Fessler took no offense and actually wrote him a letter to that effect, and they released the letter as well. So, you know, this was a private party at a private club, mm-hmm. and as far as I know, there's no audio or video recording out there. If anybody does have it, I'd be happy to take that in my Dropbox account. But, you know, what's really bad about this is that it happened, like, right after they sat through sexual harassment training. I looked at the attendance sheet for the House members, and pretty much everybody took it. Everybody who was at that event sat through this sexual harassment training.
Representative Nikki Antonio, a Lakewood Democrat, has said that House Speaker Cliff Rosenberger's quote-unquote zero tolerance for such behavior doesn't really mean anything since he's not doing anything about it.
It's also interesting, given the Speaker's past when it comes to these issues, when everything came out with Cliff Height and Wes Goodman, so two former legislators who had issues, records were requested, and we found out that there were four House members who did have complaints against them, some sort of anti-harassment, filed under anti-harassment rules, And in each of those cases, all four House members, two Democrats, two Republicans, they lost their leadership roles. If they were chairs on a committee, if they were ranking members on a – they lost their leadership roles. Mm-hmm. So it is interesting now in an event where the speaker was actually attending to see it happen and for Representative Seitz to not see any sort of demotion is kind of out of character based on the history of these other complaints.
Is anybody going to back down on this, or is it just going to go away?
It's hard to say at this point. I think, especially given like the past history of people losing leadership positions because of poor behavior, I think that's something people might continue to push for. But I know the speaker has said repeatedly that Representative Seitz apologized and kind of feels like that is an adequate way to resolve this topic. They also, the speaker talked about creating a like task force of sorts to, you know, bipartisan discussions about sexual harassment and how to improve culture at the State House. Mm. I don't know what will come from that.
It's just wild. We just heard this a few months ago. We just heard, hey, you know, we're taking these things seriously. We're going to go to anti-harassment training. And then hours later, days later, something like this happens again. So I don't know what happens when you now create a task force.
Now, Representative Seitz hasn't been around. Has he shown up lately? I know he injured his ankle falling at the same event.
Yeah, the night of the roast, he missed a step coming down the stairs at the Athletic Club of Columbus, and he was taken by ambulance and had to have surgery on his leg.
And have we seen hide or hair of him?
I think he's
getting around.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I will say, I think when Laura asked the speaker last week about all of this, the speaker, I think, even said that he wanted to have a word with Representative Seitz that night after the event. But because he was taken to the hospital, he wasn't able to do so.
Oh. That would have been a little bit awkward.
Yeah.
Can you just wait there?
Hey, yeah, hang on. Hold the ambulance for a second. I got to talk to this guy. You know, and the other thing is, like, you know, there's 99 members of the House. It's always there's always somebody misbehaving.
Yeah, but these are two leaders. These are
I'm thinking
Bill Seitz is a longtime member of the Ohio General Assembly. He's one of those guys that's been going back and forth.
He's been
ping ponging
between the two chambers.
Yeah, and Matt Huffman, as we've mentioned, has been entrusted with the redistricting legislation.
And I will say, at the same forum where the speaker said that Seitz was not going to lose any leadership roles, Senate President Larry Obhoff was asked what would happen to Matt Huffman. Is he done with all the punishment for Huffman? And he said they're still considering what to do with him. So they're still considering a possible loss of leadership. And you have to wonder if maybe this whole redistricting thing is just putting any future punishment on hold.
Yeah, I was going to say, has it affected the redistricting negotiations?
I will say I've talked to some people who have been in that room, and they say it is interesting to go through this with somebody on the other side of the table who they know that he has said those things.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, Senate President Larry Obhoff wasn't there that night, found out about it shortly thereafter, and, you know, addressed it with Matt Huffman as soon as possible. So just given our discussion about the speaker.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is our weekly reporters roundtable. You just heard from Jesse Ballmert of the Cincinnati Inquirer. Also with us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Democratic gubernatorial candidate Dennis Kucinich unveiled a plan that would bar charter school officials from making campaign contributions, and he also wants a statewide vote on a constitutional amendment that would allow local school boards to decide whether they want charter schools. All of this is to the point of how Democrats are going to use the charter school scandals and the reputation Ohio has for its lackluster oversight of charter schools in the upcoming election cycle. What do you think? You know, Andy Chow is I know the Dispatch had a big story in it over the weekend.
Well, it's safe to assume that a lot of this is based off of ECOT, the Electronic Classroom of Tomorrow. Mm-hmm. It was the state's largest online charter school. It closed, and about 12,000 students had to find a new school to go to, and that includes more than 2,000 people who are on set to graduate. So the question here is what do lawmakers do next? What do state officials do next when it comes to charter schools? And it sounds like what Dennis Kucinich wants to do from the Democratic side is really spur people for votes who think that charter schools are that charter schools need to be reined in some more and to give more local control to school boards who don't want charter schools in their districts.
You know, I think that the Democrats in general are going to be hammering all of the Republicans who are running for statewide office, saying that they are tainted by these campaign donations that they receive from ECOT, from Bill Lager. You know, you heard David Pepper last week at that same Associated Press forum was saying that, you know, this is bigger than CoinGate. CoinGate was the Bureau of Workers' Compensation investment scandal that led to, you know, convictions of, I think, 21 out of 20,
including
20 out
governor.
Of 21, including the sitting governor. And so I think that the Democrats are, they may be divided over who gets to be governor, but I think they all see this as a big Achilles heel for Republicans.
And like you said, the dispatch pointed out over the weekend is that the two of the big times when Democrats were able to seize control from Republicans in statewide races were based off of other scandals. So it's proven to work for Democrats in the past. I think that this kind of thing does motivate people to get out and vote for Democrats. We've seen it nationwide where it seems like people are motivated to go out and vote for Democrats anyway as a backlash to any anti-President Trump feels. So I wonder if it's going to resonate. I wonder if it's really going to connect with people. I mean, especially since ECOT just happened, I wonder how much is that going to motivate people in November?
I thought it was interesting, and I don't think it might have been the Dispatch, but it was something I read recently that it made the salient point that most Republicans who vote and have supported charter schools over the years come from districts where there are no charter schools. They are voting on something that doesn't even affect their own constituents.
Yeah, a lot of the charter schools are based in the cities and the big cities of Ohio, which tend to be more Democratic leaning areas. So I think that's certainly a point. I think the counterpoint that Republicans are going to make, and I know this because they've already made it, is that, you know, they were the ones that were in control when they looked at tighter, you know, laws on charter schools and kind of the audits that the Dave Yost, the state auditor, is going to pursue on these schools. The other argument is, you know, Dave Yost spoke at ECOT graduation ceremony. So, yes, I think this will be a campaign issue. I think the Republicans have some points that they're going to make on the other side that, yeah, maybe this was a bad school, but look how we tried to rein it in.
And I think politically it's easier for it's an easier message to get across for the Democrats. For the Democrats to say charter schools are scamming people, or charter schools don't run off of no accountability and they're run by people who give a lot to Republicans. That's an easier message than kind of what Jesse was saying. Hey, Republicans can say, well, yeah, charter schools are good. There are some bad charter schools out there. But hey, we wanted more accountability. And yes, we attended ECOT events. But I think it's harder for Republicans to walk that line and sell that as a campaign point.
They've been in control for so long now, they have to start owning a lot of stuff as it, you know, if something goes wrong. They were the ones in charge.
Sure. And even if they don't have charter schools in their own districts, I think it's more of an ideological line in that you know, I think a lot of Republicans support school choice. They say that if you're in a failing public school and you shouldn't be stuck sending your kids there just because that's your zip code, that you should have options such as charter schools, such as vouchers to private schools, et cetera. And so this is something that, you know, a lot of Democrats, some Democrats have supported school choice, limited school choice. I think Republicans in general support it more extensively.
Let's take a break right now. It's our weekly reporters roundtable. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Cincinnati Enquirer, state government reporter Jesse Ballmert, Dayton Daily News correspondent Laura Bischoff, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. The president is in Cincinnati today to sell his tax cut plan, but the larger story is who's in Cincinnati with him? Jesse Ballmert?
Yeah, I'm not actually in Cincinnati with them, but all my great colleagues are. So we got it covered. So basically, once Trump announced he was coming to Ohio and Cincinnati specifically, I contacted basically all of the people running for governor and Senate and were like, hey, are you going to show up? And so very quickly, I think Mary Taylor, who's running for governor, and her running mate, Nathan Estruth, said that they were going to be there. And so that was important. I think she is really trying to appeal to Trump's mm-hmm. base and supporters. And so I think it was really important for her to be there. Mike DeWine's campaign got back to me. Mike DeWine will not actually be there. He has something pre-scheduled out of state, but John Husted, his running mate and lieutenant governor pick, will be there. Rob Portman will be there, which we think is about the first time that Rob Portman has appeared with Donald Trump in Ohio, if you'll recall.
That's surprising in a way.
He didn't actually vote for the president.
Right.
I think he wrote in Mike Pence's name. And so that's interesting. Jim Renacci is touting that he's going to be there, a U.S. Senate candidate. And then Mike Gibbons, another U.S. Senate candidate, is like, hey, guys, remember me. I liked Trump before Jim Renacci was even in this race. So it is almost people kind of like Republicans almost falling over themselves to say how much they endorse the president and his tax plan.
Because they have to get through the primary.
Right. Being pro-Trump in the Republican primary seems to be pretty popular. And like Jesse says, they're kind of falling over each other over who's more Trumpian than the other. But I think that, I think then after whoever wins the nomination on the Republican side will then have to start moving to the center. They always do. Because I think that with Donald Trump's popularity is at what, like 40%, 35, 40%?
Historic lows
for president at this point in his presidency. Mm-hmm. So I think that, there's going to be some, as there usually is, some political tap dancing after the primary.
Which is an interesting thing to point out, that DeWine's not going to be there, because if he were to win the Republican nomination, then he can more easily distance himself from somebody like President Trump in the general election, even though he was more of a more verbal supporter of Trump when he was running for president in Ohio compared to Kasich, Portman, even Husted in some ways.
Yeah, there is this kind of interesting Republicans trying to fit themselves somewhere between Donald Trump and John Kasich. And you saw that even late last week when the president said some disparaging remarks about the governor at a RNC event, and that came out. And Mary Taylor was tweeting stuff like, some leaders in the state want to take pot shots at the president while throwing around irresponsible labels like autocrat and tyrant. So that's kind of her jab at John Kasich, her running mate, and also the person who's endorsed her.
Say his name, Mary.
And last week? It's all blurring together. John Kasich was asked, Mary Taylor says she hasn't talked to you in a year. Is that true? Do you still support her for governor? And he did not back down from his endorsement of her at all. He gave her a big hug, like, I think she's going to make a great governor. I firmly stand behind her. In the meantime, she is just like running as far away as she can.
Is this like, water torture for her to have to
Meaning, like, is he killing her with kindness?
Yeah,
is it,
right.
Is it, well, I don't know if it was that passive.
One could draw that conclusion,
right? He did make a lot of points about, hey, she's her own independent person. She can think whatever she wants. She's allowed to have her own thoughts. He said that she would make a great governor. But at this point, you got to ask is he helping or hurting her more
with his enthusiastic endorsements?
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He will not be in Cincinnati, by the way.
Yeah, the governor?
I
haven't checked, but I'm sure he isn't.
That's a good question.
That's probably one I should have checked on, but I guess I just assumed. Anyway, and he did say, like, essentially, Mary Taylor, it is a political campaign. He expects a certain amount of distancing from him, and especially in areas like, for example, Claremont County, where he is perhaps less beloved than in other parts of the state. A lot of people are still upset about Medicaid expansion. A lot of people are still upset about his comments about Trump, and either that they wish he wouldn't say anything, or, you know, specifically that they feel like he's attacked them and the president in these ways. So I think it would be almost kind of hypocritical if John Kasich said, it's not okay for Mary Taylor to attack me, but it's okay for me to attack the president in these kind of verbal ways.
Huh. Yeah, exactly. 614-292-8513 if you have a question or comment. What else is going on? So what other deadlines? February 7th, we talked about that deadline in terms of redistricting. Anything else? Candidates?
Well, yeah, the candidates have to sign up for the May primary, and so we'll make sure that all of them are doing so. They also have to have the proper number of signatures and so forth. So I think that's something we'll all be watching.
The campaign finance reports came in last week.
That's right.
And, you know, Mike DeWine's campaign has over $10 million cash on hand. He was helped in large part by $1 million loan that he made to his own campaign, as well as like $4.6 million or so that came over from the Houston campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Rich Cordray managed to raise $2 million in a really short period of time. About half of that came from out-of-state sources, according to the Dispatch story that I read. And
it looks like Betty Sutton, when he brought her on, she did not bring anything with her.
It was like
she
maybe 100 and something thousand.
111,000, I believe. So not the $4.6 million dollars that Mike DeWine got
the,
from John Houston.
Right.
And the other interesting thing in campaign finance was Mary Taylor has like $3.5 million on hand, but $3 million of that came from a personal loan from her, and about $250,000 came from her running mate alone that he made.
Right. So, she has not really raised outside money then.
Renacci's report showed that he loaned $6.6 million to his campaign. Mm-hmm. So between the Taylor campaign, the Renacci campaign, and the DeWine campaign, we're talking like $10 million in loans from
in personal wealth.
In personal loans
involved, yeah.
But the deadline for filing is coming up at 4 o'clock on Wednesday, so we'll see if everybody who's been talking about running for governor, if they're all in. Dennis Kucinich and Bill O'Neill, Democrats who are running, they did not have to file campaign finance reports because their campaigns weren't formed until 2018.
Okay, so when their first reports?
Their first reports would be the pre-primary in late April. So we really don't have a glimpse of, you know, financially how those guys are doing.
And that's kind of the challenge of some of these people jumping in so late, mm-hmm. is you don't have a good sense of their financial ability to win at the very least.
But jumping in late also brings you some momentum where you can build off of the press coverage. Laura brought up that Dennis Kucinich has been getting a lot of coverage lately, getting a lot of headlines, and sort of sucking up some of the attention that Rich Cordray was getting at the end of last year. There's a lot of people vying for attention, especially on the Democratic side right now.
Brian in Upper Arlington, you're on the air. Hi, Brian.
Good morning. I just had some questions about some of the more, I guess, down ballot state races, attorney general, auditor, things of that nature. I know Dave Yost, I've seen banted around as running for the Republican candidate for attorney general, and I was just curious if he might have a challenger or who the Democrats might put up for various state offices. and I'll take my your comments off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Brian.
So the Attorney General's office, Steve Dettelbach, he's the former U.S. attorney from the Northern District of Ohio. He is the declared candidate. I think he outraised Yoast.
For the Democrats.
He's
a Democrat. Mm-hmm.
Did I say Democrat?
No, Brian was asking if Yoast was going to face any Republican challengers.
He was asking both.
I just wanted to
clarify. Yeah, I don't think there's any primaries in the down ticket races except for treasurer. There's Sandy O'Brien from Ashtabula County is also running against Robert Sprague.
Mm-hmm. There's also a Democratic primary for treasurer. Neil Patel Robert Richardson.
Right.
Yeah, so just to kind of run down them, Dave Yoast is the Republican running for Attorney General. The Democrat in that race is Steve Dettelbach, as Laura said. In Auditor, you have Keith Faber, who is the Republican who is running against
Zach Space,
mm-hmm. former Faber, U.S. Congressman.
Right, and Faber, former Senate President.
Current representative.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. And for treasurer on the Democratic side, you have Rob Richardson, who is kind of a Cincinnati figure. He ran for mayor and kind of came in third place there, but has big union ties, especially through his family. He would be facing off against Neil Patel, who is another Democrat who kind of recently made a bid. And like we said, Robert Sprague would be the Republican in that race, and Sandra O'Brien
from Ashtabula County.
And then I don't know. Did you mention Secretary of State?
No, that's the last one.
Frank LaRose is running as a Republican for Secretary of State. Kathleen Clyde running for the Democratic nomination. Frank LaRose is a current state senator. Kathleen Clyde is a current state representative. I don't think there's any other.
And I will point out that Sandy O'Brien won the Republican nomination for treasurer back in 2006 and went up against Rich Cordray. Hmm. She primaried the sitting treasurer, Jeanette Bradley.
Uh-huh.
And
that's right.
You know, won the nomination.
That's right. That's right.
And there's also a guy who I think he's a Democrat. He's a physician at the Cleveland Clinic, a guy named John Heavey, and he loaned his started a campaign for governor, and he loaned his campaign $1.5 million. And we'll see if that guy files.
Well, speaking of that and other people who have loaned their campaigns millions, Rob in Canton, you're on the air. Hi, Rob.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
My question is this. If all these people have millions of dollars to lend to their campaigns, what are they going to get out of the office of governor? I mean, what's the pay scale for Ohio governor? And who's going to make up all this difference in money for them? I mean, if they lend $6 million to their campaign and become governor, who's going to pay all that back?
Well, that's exactly it. The idea is they'll get paid back, right?
Yes.
Raising money.
The history has been that candidates may loan themselves money, and typically they forgive the loan.
Okay.
I think Mike DeWine loaned himself money when he was running for attorney general the first time, and he did not forgive the loan. And so the Dayton Daily, we wrote back when we had an editorial page, they editorialized against that, saying that, it's raised a lot of ethical questions of having campaign donations, go to the attorney general's campaign account, make a pit stop there, and then go to his personal account to pay off that loan.
Uh-huh.
So it is uncharted territory in terms of, if some of these people who have loaned themselves money, if they become governor and then if they don't forgive the loan, how does that look? That then they would be maybe raising money to pay themselves back while they're mm-hmm. sitting governor.
But on the other hand, the point that Rob made too is, what do they get out? I mean,
pay for governor is like what, $149?
I just looked up. $149,000, which is more than I make, but not perhaps as much as they could make in the private sector. I think it just goes to how expensive these campaigns are. That and also the three Republican candidates, now two Republican candidates with Jim Renacci going to the Senate race.
Which is a crazy race as well.
They have some independent wealth. Like, these people have money to loan themselves. Mm-hmm. So that helps them in ways that maybe some of the Democrats don't.
Yeah. Rob, thanks for that. I guess what they get is they get elected to public office, and
they get to be governor. And, you know, that's a really powerful position. You have 55,000 employees through state government. You have control over a biennial budget that runs, you know, like billions and billions of dollars. You get to set policy.
Yeah.
And you get driven around by the troopers.
Yeah, there you go.
I wanted to also mention, you know, we named a lot of names running for governor in the statewide races. Constance Goodell Newton is the candidate for the Green Party running
for governor.
And I don't think we mentioned that Connie Pillich is running, and Joe Schiavone. Connie Pillich is a former state representative from Cincinnati, and Joe Schiavone is state senator from the Youngstown area. They are both running as Democrats as well.
For governor, right.
So on the Democratic ticket, or Democratic primary for governor, is Rich Cordray, Dennis Kucinich, Bill O'Neill, Connie Pillich, Joe Schiavone, and maybe this John Heavey guy. Did I miss anybody?
No.
It's a lot to keep track of, but then you got to pity the poor reporters who covered the Republican primary for president.
Right, the cast of thousands.
Nothing will ever measure up to that. What else this week? So we've got the filing deadline on February 7th. What else are they at work on? What are you looking at?
We've been keeping an eye on the unemployment compensation reform. That's been something that it's been moving through House committee. There's a plan out there that was brought out by House Republicans. Its supporter says that it basically balances the burden between labor buy-in and business buy-in, but both groups have yet to come out in support of it. So it's still a bill to revamp unemployment compensation, the fund that pays out benefits to people who are laid off. But labor and business still have yet to come out for it.
This thing has been broken for several years, and there's just not enough money coming in and too much money going out. It's a chronic problem, and it becomes an acute problem whenever there's a recession.
Which we're due for.
We're kind of due for. So they need to fix this, and it's super unpopular because the fixes are businesses pay more in unemployment taxes, employers get less in benefits, or a combination of those two. And so you have both sides have been kind of at loggerheads for several years.
Is the Ohio General Assembly expected to move forward with something even if those two groups don't agree?
Well, they haven't in the last several years.
But I wonder, there's a big poker chip on the table right now, because like Laura said, if they don't pass anything soon, we are going to hit another recession. We're going to run out of money.
Faster than we did the last
one. Way faster. And you have to get something passed soon so you can start building up that pot now.
Right.
You don't want to get up to like a couple of months before we hit a recession and then all of a sudden reform the system.
And the thing is that if it runs out of money, automatically Ohio has to borrow money from the federal government. And the federal government charges interest on this.
Yep.
And so the last time it went broke in like 2009 or so, Ohio ended up borrowing like more than $3 billion and got charged, I think, more than $225 million in interest. And it cannot be paid out of that. The interest cannot be paid out of that fund. It has to come from the general fund.
Right.
And so this is a very expensive problem if they don't fix it.
That affects every taxpayer. That affects
every taxpayer.
Well, and then that's money that isn't going to other things that the state might need. Also, businesses pay a penalty after a certain period of time, so they're not pumped about that either. So to whether this will actually get accomplished, I think I'm more optimistic than I have been in the past. They do seem like this is something they know is a problem. Not that they haven't known that in the past, but there is some pressure to get it done just because of the timeline. Once again, a deadline.
Yeah, but which is more likely to get fixed, redistricting or unemployment compensation?
Oh, my gosh. I don't know. Kirk Schering's involved in both.
Yeah. Poor Kirk Schering. He's from the Canton area, and he seems to be the go-to guy whenever there's a—
He's the fixer.
He's the fixer whenever there's a giant mess.
So. Oh, Laura Bischoff, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
It's Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks to you as well.
Happy Monday.
And Jesse Bollmert of the Cincinnati Enquirer. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ann.
Sorry you can't be in Cincinnati today.
Yeah, that's the breaks.
Thanks to everybody else for listening. Thanks for the calls. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.